Radio EcoShock.
It is hard to believe, but in the mid-latitudes where most of us live, winters are warming faster than summers. Except, severely cold air can suddenly break out of the Arctic. Due to changes in the upper atmosphere, a key study shows cold air outbreaks become more likely as the planet warms. The lead author is Professor Edward Hanna from the University of Lincoln, UK. Dr. Hanna published more than 150 peer-reviewed papers. He was a contributing author on the IPCC Fifth Assessment Report and a fellow of the Royal Meteorological Society. Published December 10, 2024, the title for this winter weather warning is Influence of High Latitude Blocking and the Northern Stratospheric Polar Vortex on Colder Outbreaks Under Arctic Amplification of Global Warming. From Lincolnshire, England, Edward Hanna, welcome back to Radio EcoShock.
Thank you very much, Alex.
If winters are generally warming, why do we care about a cold snap now and then?
So you're right that winters are generally getting warmer in most parts of the planet in the last few decades with human-driven global warming. However, there's always variability with extreme weather events and with climate change. So each year is not necessarily progressively warmer than the previous year. You get fluctuations for a whole variety of reasons. And these include cold winter spells sometimes. So, and also with the warming trend, we're perhaps expecting these cold spells less often than we used to. And so, or less severe than they used to be. And so we're less prepared for them when they do occur. And so we still have been seeing at times some pretty severe winter spells propagating from high northern latitudes in the Arctic down to much lower middle latitudes, such as London, for example, or New York, or that whole band around the middle latitudes of the northern hemisphere. So these cold events continue to occur, albeit on average not as cold as they used to be, but we're perhaps less prepared for them than we used to be. And so we need to deal with this idea that there will always be variations amongst that background of global warming.
Yes, there was a terrible cold snap went down into Texas a few years ago. They weren't ready. The refineries froze up. There was no gas. All sorts of problems. Some people died. So, yes, people aren't ready for what could happen. Now, you led a paper with well-known co-authors like Jennifer Francis, James Overland, and Judah Cohen. What did your group set out to do?
So that's a good question. So I actually organised a workshop in Lincoln, UK in late 2023 when most of these people together, and also quite a few top experts from Asia as well. Although obviously being in the Northern Hemisphere issue, it's tends to be not Southern Hemisphere people involved. It's from across the Northern Hemisphere. So we had some really good discussions about where we thought the current gaps in the research on strong Arctic warming and linking that with extreme weather events further afield of the Arctic. So in these densely populated northern hemisphere mid-latitude continents where several hundreds of millions of people live. And so obviously people can be profoundly affected by various extreme weather events. And also you've got the what we call the jet stream, which is a giant current of air in the atmosphere in the northern hemisphere, crosses many of these northern hemisphere mid-latitude regions. So we really wanted to understand where the gaps in the knowledge and understanding were when we're looking at connecting what is happening with very strong warming, particularly of the Arctic regions or the high northern latitudes, the connectivity with the extreme weather events further south. And so from those discussions in the workshop, we really put together some research priorities. And then we were sort of invited, or I was invited, to lead a research synthesis for a fairly newish journal, but from a reputable publisher called Environmental Research Climate. And so that paper came out last December. And so it's an attempt to really convey to the wider science community and to interested other people the kind of situation where we need to go with better understanding these connections between Arctic and mid-latitude climate change and mid-latitude extreme weather events in the Northern Hemisphere.
And tell us about the warm Arctic cold continents theory.
So this is a theory that was first put forward by Dr. James Overland of NOAA and colleagues, I think about just over 15 years ago, originally when it was first published in some papers. So the idea that we're seeing very strong warming over the Arctic, which I think we're going to discuss in a bit, But at the same time, we continue to see cold winter spells further south of the Arctic, particularly over the North America and over Eurasia. So it's kind of topsy-turvy or upside down temperature extremes from what you might expect, where normally you might expect cold conditions or record cold conditions in the Arctic and warmer conditions further south. But actually, some of these temperature patterns or the patterns of the temperature anomalies have flipped on average at times in the last few decades. And so that's what it's really referring to, where we're having still the at times very cold conditions in the northern continents.
Over a decade ago, Jennifer Francis suggested a link between disappearing sea ice and winter cold outbreaks. Francis told us on Radio EcoShock she cannot say loss of Arctic sea ice is causing winter weakening in the jet stream, but both changes do occur together. Judah Cohen added the amount of snow cover on land as a factor, especially in Siberia. What is your assessment of the role of disappearing Arctic sea ice and the risk of cold winter outbreaks in North America or Europe?
So the cold weather outbreak in Europe and other extreme weather events, here we're talking obviously about the Northern Hemisphere winter in Europe and the US, the sea ice changes are a possible influence on those changes in extreme mid-latitude cold winter spells, but there's many possible influences because these cold winter spells in mid-latitudes are caused or directly connected with changes in the jet stream that I've already mentioned in the Northern Hemisphere mid-latitude jet stream. And there's many possible causes of those jet stream changes, including changes in tropical climate systems, more locally in the, with the mid-latitude atmospheric or medium-scale storm systems or cyclones, and also further afield teleconnections in the polar regions and elsewhere, and also changes higher up in the atmosphere, in the stratosphere, as well as changes in factors beyond, such as changes in variation of the power from the sun that can interact with the upper atmosphere of the Earth, and even volcanic eruptions that can affect things like aerosol heating and cooling in different, and chemical reactions in different parts of the higher up in the Earth's atmosphere. So there's actually many factors that can cause the jet stream in the mid-latitudes, and therefore these extreme weather events such as the cold spells to vary. But the Arctic sea ice changes, and we've seen a massive reduction in Arctic sea ice in the last few decades, since about 1980 or so, are certainly one possible cause amongst probably a dozen or more different drivers. The difficulty is that the period of really strong Arctic warming, when the sea ice has been reducing very dramatically, particularly since the 1990s or the early 2000s, is a very short time period in terms of being able to say whether changes in the data are significant or not from a mathematical point of view, given all the variability in the data. So that's why there is a very strong debate in the current literature between different groups of scientists over whether or not there is a direct cause and effect between the very strong Arctic sea ice reduction and the winter cold spells in mid-latitudes. So the jury's still out on that one. We don't really have enough data. And of course, climate models are also used to try to assess this, but the models themselves are not perfect tools. So they're very useful to supplement the data, but the models themselves have their own challenges in using them to decipher the results from them. And so it's really a very active area of research.
Please explain, what is Arctic amplification, the mechanics at play when very cold air can escape the Arctic and move further south?
So Arctic amplification is essentially it's near surface or surface atmospheric warming of the high latitudes. It occurs actually in both hemispheres, so in the southern hemisphere as well, but it's particularly pronounced in the Arctic. And it's where the Arctic near surface or surface air has warmed four times as strongly as the global average warming in the last four decades, so since about 1980s or so. And so this is the most, on average, the most rapidly warming region of the planet is the Arctic. And there's a number of different reasons for this. The main one that has been given, although it's not necessarily the main one that operates in practice, is something called the ice albedo feedback, albedo being reflectivity of the Earth's surface, which dramatically reduces if you're removing ice and snow cover from large parts of the Arctic. That darkens the surface. You absorb extra radiation from the sun. That's when there is the sun. Obviously, during the polar winter, there's not much sun. And so there's actually other feedbacks that are equally, if not more, even more important. such as what we call the ice ocean heat flux feedback. So when you're removing sea ice cover through some initial warming, then you're effectively removing a lid from the ocean, where the ocean is able to radiate a lot more heat compared with before into the lower atmosphere, particularly in the autumn and the early winter. And remember here that when we're talking about cold spells, the winter season is of greatest interest. So this idea about radiating more heat from the sea to the air, I think is a tremendously important mechanism for amplifying the global warming in the Arctic region. And there's other feedbacks as well. And they're acting in tandem to cause this very pronounced warming of the Arctic, as I said, about four times greater than the global warming average.
And your paper's about fast-moving air currents in the stratosphere, about 6 miles or 10 kilometers above the surface. How can changes in the stratosphere rearrange our weather lower down in the troposphere where we live?
That's a really good question. The stratosphere, which is this layer of the atmosphere about 10 or 15 kilometers up to about 50 or more kilometers above the Earth's surface, is not always connected with the lower down part of the atmosphere called the troposphere. But nevertheless, there can be transfer of energy and waves between the two layers of the atmosphere that can influence the conditions in the other layer of the atmosphere where the waves come from. So the waves can propagate either upwards from the troposphere into the stratosphere or downwards from the stratosphere into the troposphere. And so what we find is that if you have some trigger changing either the jet stream in the troposphere, that this can cause atmospheric blocking, so where you get regions of more stable air masses and high air pressure near the Earth's surface. This can be linked with movement of waves in the air up into the stratosphere, which can in turn influence the what we call the polar vortex, which is a mass of cold air that forms each season in the stratosphere. This can be influenced by conditions in the troposphere. And vice versa, if you have some changing conditions with the polar vortex, which is a mass of cold rotating cold air in the stratosphere, this in turn can propagate down to the troposphere and influence the jet stream there. And this sort of coupling between these two layers of the atmosphere is not entirely well understood, but it can have profound implications or impacts on weather conditions near the Earth's surface. For example, if there's some warming of the stratosphere that can then propagate through this wave action down to the lower part of the atmosphere, the troposphere, and weaken the jet stream in the troposphere, that can then lead to colder air outbreaks forming nearer the Earth's surface in the mid-latitude regions.
A majority of papers examining severe cold air outbreaks are about the United States. I find less about observations in Northern Europe and even less for Russia and China. Are we talking about a global phenomenon, and are there examples in Europe or Russia?
You're right. A lot of the research has been concerned with the impacts of the Eastern and Central North American cold spells in recent years. But we have also had a number of these cold spells in Eurasia and Northern Europe and going as far east as China, Korea and Japan as well. Very notable cold spells actually. And there have been actually quite a large number of papers on these. There's a very famous example called the Beast from the East that affected Northwest Europe and the UK, for example, in February, March 2018. And actually just last winter, on both sides of the Atlantic, you had a very record cold spell which propagated unusually far south in the US to affect the Gulf Coast, and in fact some of the deepest snow on records, or at least back into the late 19th century, and very low temperatures as well over the course of a week or two in January 2025. And also last winter there were a couple of notable cold air outbreaks coming from the Arctic to affect weather conditions in the UK as well. And so it's argued that these were linked to changes, at least in part to changes in the stratosphere where the polar vortex conditions may have influenced or been linked to jet stream changes lower down in the atmosphere. If you look quite closely at there's a huge body of papers being produced. You can find good examples also of cold air outbreaks over Eastern Asia, so particularly Korea and Japan, which are influenced by changes in the near surface what we call a high pressure that forms over Siberia in many winters due to the very cold continental conditions that form seasonally over Siberia. And that high pressure can be influenced by conditions upstream, so going further northwest with reduced Arctic sea ice that we discussed a bit earlier in this interview about the recent reductions in Arctic sea ice. So, for example, over the Barents Kara seas, north of Russia, that particular part of the Arctic Ocean has warmed very rapidly in the last 2 decades or so. And that's influenced some of the conditions in the lower atmosphere above that region, which in turn has had impacts downstream in the atmosphere, which in atmospheric terms means going further east over the Ural region and further east over Siberia, which in turn has influenced, has caused propagation of cold northerly winds down over that eastern part of Asia. So there's actually quite a body of work that's reported on some of those results. So it is actually pretty much all round the mid-latitude belt, but focused over those particular continental regions where you have certain weather systems preferentially forming because of things like the differences in heating and cooling between the land and the sea. The land tends to cool down the big continents more in the winter than the surrounding oceans, for example, and also connected with the things like Rocky Mountain ranges and the Ural Mountains, which are oriented more or less north-south and influence where some of these weather systems preferentially form.
Well, I know from October 2023 to January 2024, a nasty cold wave settled over Scandinavia and parts of Russia. And while the rest of the world was record warm, this so-called cold blob made a half dozen countries colder than normal for months. And one of the best season forecasters, Copernicus Climate Change Service, did not predict this cold blob, even when their model was started in October 2023, when the cold air had already arrived. What is the problem with predicting these sudden cold air outbreaks, and can we do better?
You see, the thing is, I think all of these climate models are in a continuous cycle of improvement, and we learn from recent events trying to improve the representation of conditions in the real atmosphere. So I think the climate models as a whole tend to struggle with capturing some of the real changes in the atmosphere or the variations of changes in jet streams and so on. They tend to underestimate the strength of these changes, but also some of the climate models still don't have a very good representation of how the stratosphere and the troposphere, so these two vertical layers of the atmosphere that we've spoken about before, how they are coupled and how you can get energy and kind of transfer of information between these two layers of the atmosphere. And also we think that with the atmosphere, you can have nonlinear effects where quite small triggers can result in large changes in different parts of the atmosphere later. So some quite subtle initial signals. It's quite hard to fully represent all these cause and effects in the climate models. So I think there is some skill in climate models at predicting certain types of changes with the polar vortex in the stratosphere. But as a whole, the models can still be improved.
In your section on stretching of the stratospheric polar vortex, it sounds like there's more energy exchange between the two layers of the atmosphere over the North Pacific and Alaska than, say, over Greenland. Are you saying interaction between the troposphere and the stratosphere is not even or the same all around the pole?
These kind of interactions that you mentioned can be regionally focused because although if you have a weakening of the polar vortex, this massive cold air spinning around the pole in the stratosphere, the way that connects with the troposphere will also be influenced by air pressure systems in the troposphere and the direction of winds regionally in the troposphere. And so those, as I mentioned, are connected quite often with geographical features or mountain ranges or differences in heating and cooling lower down in the atmosphere. So the impacts of having a change in the polar vortex can be regionally focused. And we know that, for example, with regions of blocking or high pressure, which is blocking is an area of persistent high pressure and still winds lower down in the atmosphere, there's preferential regions where they tend to form, such as Greenland, Alaska, and North Pacific, so regions such as you mentioned. So it's a bit like having giant boulders in a river that can affect the flow of the air in the atmosphere, to give a very simple analogy. Certainly, we do see regionality of that connection between those two atmospheric layers. Again, it's not perfectly understood.
And further complicating stratospheric detective work, there is an almost clock-like wind cycle called the quasi-biennial oscillation, QBO. I hadn't heard a lot about it. I had to look it up. What is it, and can it affect severe winter outbreaks in the mid-latitudes?
So the QBO, or quasi-biennial oscillation, is a another jet stream compared with the one that we've discussed so far. This is a jet stream that is higher up in the atmosphere. It's in the stratosphere, but it's also in the lower latitudes, so the equatorial regions of the northern hemisphere. And it's caused by tropical weather systems producing waves in the atmosphere that, a bit like the waves we've previously discussed, can rise from the troposphere into the stratosphere. And then these waves subsequently break in the stratosphere because the air there is relatively rarefied compared with lower down in the atmosphere. This then produces a force that causes this jet stream to form, called the QBO. It can reverse direction between east and west every 26 or 28 months or so. And it turns out that if you change conditions high up in the stratosphere, like the QBO in the tropical regions, that this can be connected dynamically, so in terms of movements of air masses in the atmosphere, with changes in higher latitudes. So there's a kind of a figure in our paper that describes these connections. But basically, if you reverse phase of the QBO between west and east, if you make it into an easterly phase, then this can increase the probability of a weakening of the polar vortex in higher latitudes of the stratosphere that we discussed, the polar vortex previously.
And then your team of top scientists say it is time for more study of the stratosphere, giving it a room of its own, so to speak. Why?
I think the issue with the stratosphere is it's higher up. There's traditionally been fewer observations than lower down in the atmosphere. It's more challenging to capture in climate models, which don't necessarily have as much detail in the stratosphere, again, because the weather that we normally experience on an everyday basis is lower down in the atmosphere. So it's been a little bit neglected historically compared with research in the troposphere. However, there has been a lot of research in parts of the stratosphere, but it's been selective in relation to the topic we're discussing today. For example, a lot of previous research has been focused around what we call sudden stratospheric warmings, which is when the stratospheric polar vortex can warm quite rapidly over a period of a few days or so. And then that can also weaken the winds in the polar vortex. And then there's a kind of wave propagation from the stratosphere down to the troposphere, and that can cause a weakening of the jet stream lower down in the atmosphere, and in turn cause some of these cold winter spells that we've been discussing. However, from not just our work that we've been reporting, but from a number of papers recently, it turns out that there are different types of changes in the stratosphere that can influence near-surface weather conditions. And we just wanted to really help draw attention to the fact that we think there's actually a wider diversity or variety of stratospheric anomalies or changes in conditions in the stratosphere that can influence extreme weather lower down in the atmosphere, compared with what conventionally has been really looked at with most of previous research. So I think that's it's really drawing attention to the fact that we need a more complete understanding of some of these anomalies and extremes with stratospheric conditions, how they're connected with lower down in the atmosphere and in terms of extreme weather events.
You're listening to EcoShock Radio for the world.
I'm Alex Smith. Get it all at our website, ecoshock.org.
Dr. Edward Hanna is on the line. We are talking severe winter weather and the stratosphere.
In the Severe Weather Europe blog, André Flies finds three key factors are lined up to predict a serious cold air outbreak next winter. And everybody from city managers to social agencies would like a prediction. Is it too soon? And if so, how far in advance can we know severe cold is on the way?
So that's a really interesting point, and they're really looking at several key factors, including the QBO that we've already discussed, but also conditions, sea ice conditions in the Arctic, and how that might be influenced with changes high up in the atmosphere above the Arctic. And then they're also looking at, sorry, ENSO, I think, in the Pacific, so El Nino, Southern Oscillation. So what they're trying to do is to predict changes in these three conditions, or looking at recent changes in these conditions, and see if that can give some clues or insights into the next few months' conditions in the stratosphere with the polar vortex activity. And I think there is something in this kind of approach. You can't get a perfect prediction, of course, from just three factors, but it's certainly part of the physical connectivity or potential connectivity of what's happening and trying to, there are some time lags with some of these, what we call teleconnections or remote links between different parts of the atmosphere or different parts of the Earth system. And so that's the basis also of some of the, for example, machine learning prediction models that try to do seasonal weather forecasting that have recently been developed.
Well, we're running out of time, but can you briefly tell us, what are you working on next?
So we're basically trying to follow up on some of the some of the ideas from the big review synthesis paper that motivated this interview. So I think a number of us are working on different parts of what's a very big research areas. So some of us looking at changes in high latitude blocking, the causes and impacts of that. Others are looking at new ways of defining variations and extreme events in the stratosphere and trying to understand how this might be linked with conditions further down with some of the extreme cold air outbreaks. But also we're trying to motivate the research from an end user or stakeholder perspective. So for example, with energy users, which is a big topic in the winter with the price of energy now in many parts of the world. For example, I've got a proposal to work with a national energy system operator here, for example, to try to better understand the societal and economic impacts of cold air outbreaks. And I guess if we could improve the weather forecast models and the global climate models to be able to predict these events and understand them, then the energy companies and other interested parties have a longer lead-in time and can make better preparations. So that's one of the ideas. But I think there is a lot more work still to do to improve the climate models. So better predictability is the key, I think, of so that we can better prepare for these events, as well as just understanding them from a scientific perspective.
From University of Lincoln, we've been speaking with Edward Hanna. He is Professor of Climate Science and Meteorology and lead author in a new study about cold air outbreaks. You can find links to all the science we talked about in my weekly show blog at ecoshock.org. Edward, thank you for coming back and sharing your valuable time with us.
Thank you very much, Alex.
I'm Alex Smith for Radio EcoShock.
Check out the Radio EcoShock website. We're at ecoshock.org.